so amazing in your hands that you could do it for hours. It's an erotic thing, what can I say? Now, the speed of the wheel is very important. If you're scared and too slow, it happens a lot in the beginning, your ball of clay won't have the force to sustain itself, and it will become a hardened, twisted blob. Defeated, you'll need to take it off the wheel, throw it in the recycling bucket, and go back to the wedging table. I usually wedge 3 or 4 balls before I sit down at the wheel, so I don't have to get up so much. So now you make the walls. You slow the wheel ever so slightly. Your hands must be wet, especially your fingers. Put your strongest finger, usually the middle, at the center of the clay mound. Your other hand is protecting it with strength and sensitivity. With the wheel spinning at its fastest centrifugal force, press the center and let the clay take your finger to what your mind's eye sees to be an inch above the base. The clay is spinning fast, and your finger will go directly to the center if you're not scared. Once you know the feel of the clay at its center on the wheel, you'll trust it and have confidence. Now, to make the walls of the vessel. You'll slow the wheel down slightly. Your finger in the mound is about to draw a line, pulling the center back toward you. This happens quickly and naturally, if you trust it. The next step is to pull up the walls. Slow the wheel considerably. If you're right-handed, you will use your left hand's fingers to go into the vessel and the fingers of your right hand for the outside. Starting at the base, your fingers press equally on either side of the wall, bringing up the walls. Beginners make the mistake of thinking that they are the ones bringing up the walls, but it's clay at the base that forms the walls naturally. You will tap the lip of the wall gently to strengthen it as it comes up. Pulling up the walls just 3 or 4 times so you don't exhaust the clay, otherwise it'll get tired and collapse. Now you've made your vessel. The cosmic forces have taken shape to form in the material realm. Is that Carl Sagan? My teacher's name was Minutia, like Minutia, which was funny because Minutia loved to go little. Her pots were tiny worlds, teapots mainly, with little spouts and lids, like Balinese rooftops the size of a pencil point. She was in her mid-40s from England, but of Russian descent, and she had distinct character. She piled her curly red hair high on her head like a pioneer woman and always dressed nicely, careful that clay would only chalk her apron. I respected her immediately. A few times as I straddled my wheel, she told me I had an erotic lower back, to which I smiled and batted my eyelashes. Minutia was the epitome of femininity to me at that time. Having produced exquisitely feminine teapots, which exhibited in galleries, she was in the process of trying to get pregnant to produce a baby, which she did in the years that she was my teacher. She was a terrific teacher, and we all adored her. She instructed us in the classic way to throw and the traditional teachings. Her own teacher had been from Japan and was a meticulous expert. She told us a story about how, before he even turned on the wheel, he'd spent several months practicing throwing the ball to the center over and over again. Throw, throw, throw. Bam, bam, bam. He already knew how to throw, but his teacher made him go back to the very beginning. Before this, he'd wedged clay to the perfect size for his teacher for a year or something. Another potter Minutia talked about was a man who made huge vessels and would slash a giant X into each of them with a pin tool, like a fencer. That was his signature. If the vessel collapsed, he tossed it. If it stayed, it was sold. How intense is that? The risk? We all paused for that one, and I fell in love for a minute. We were just students, challenged in simply making what would be dishes for earrings or containers of salt. In the beginning, throwing was the best. Getting into the sensuality of the clay and centering for hours, my mind would go right to the stars and into the dirt and think about how we're so disconnected from where things actually come from, that there's so much more energy in things and objects than we give them credit for. I think of cavemen and the first cave woman who threw a pot from a kick wheel. I think of how excited and pleased she must have been, how hairy her eyebrows were. Or if one of her caveman friends ever threw a pot at her, how quick she was to duck out of the way, and how fun that was for everybody. And there was a time when vessels held offerings to the gods. And we know this because we've seen those pictures painted in pyramids. We see now, in museums, how clumsy and childish those relics were. Minutia reminded me of Glenn Close in Dangerous Liaisons, corseted in her upright posture. There's a scene where John Malkovich asks her how she managed to invent herself, and she says, "Women are obliged to be far more skillful than men." How she stabbed a fork in her hand under the table because it drove her bonkers to be pleasant in the face of some disgusting troll man. If I had directed that movie, I would have had bugs coming out of the wigs every now and then, allowing the scenes to have even more passion. I made composite pieces that Minutia described as chaos control. I had improved some and would throw off the hump, where I'd center a bigger amount of clay, around 4 balls worth, to make vessels from the top of the mound. I'd catch the clay fabric that would spin off the mound by accident, or sometimes with intention by pinching my fingers to catch the collapse. The torn pieces would then dry to leather hard along with the vessels, and I'd put them on a wood tray to cook under a heat lamp. They'd be assembled to form something that looked like a strange flower or wreckage from a spacecraft. I was invited to fire some of my pieces at a fellow student's house upstate where she did raku fire rings in her kiln, which take place outside. Raku is a type of Japanese pottery dating back to the 16th century. This process is fired by the atmosphere within the kiln at the most molten state, a few thousand degrees Fahrenheit. A normal firing isn't as hot. Your piece is glowing red hot when it's taken out of the raku kiln. With tongs, it's placed into containers filled with your favorite combustible materials, sawdust, horsehair, leaves, paper, or copper wire. It will react, creating its own atmosphere. The result is left to the forces of smoke, forming an imprint designed by this new atmosphere. Filmmaker Rich Siebert has a beautiful video on Vimeo of the ceramic master William Shiro called Raku. One of the things Shiro says is, every piece is unique and one of a kind, and it's that way intentionally. And it evokes an emotion inside you. The studio became a co-op while I was there, so I joined. I got my own set of keys, and a group of us would go in at night to drink wine and whine about guys and throw. We tended to our pieces as if they were little babies, placing them carefully on a wooden board and wrapping them in cellophane to keep them moist. It wasn't uncommon for someone to say, "Look, it's a family," and show you their board. As a member of the board, I had to perform certain duties like clean the place, recycle the old clay into new clay, hard work, wedge the clay, which hurt my back, sweep the studio, which was boring and dried out my nose. If you couldn't or didn't want to do the chores, you paid $15 a week. Well, I could spare the 15 bucks and paid the money a few times to do away with the dirty work. I thought it was cool until one of the members came over to my wheel while I was in my zone and tapped me on the shoulder. A tap in the shoulder never feels good, does it? I jumped a little and took out my earbuds, interrupting my Brian Eno music. She squatted next to me. "You haven't been doing your duties," she said. "I know," I said. "I've been focusing and, you know, meditating. I paid the fee, so..." She breathed in deeply through her nose and, nodding to herself, said, "Well, I just don't think that you want other people to think that you think you're special." I sighed and said, "But I am." She looked at me blank-faced. "I'm famous." She blinked a few times. "Okay," I said, trying to explain myself. "Say I'm standing looking at vegetables at a grocery store, holding a big bag of carrots, and someone taps me on the shoulder and scares the crap out of me and then says he's a fan. That's not an average day at the grocery store." She took in what I had to say and went about her duties and left me to my centering. Every person is unique and one of a kind, and it's that way intentionally. Every person evokes an emotion inside you.
27. It's mine. Nora Ephron loved butter. Almost everyone at her memorial service spoke about her love of butter. Their speeches were savored, like butter. Mike Nichols, Tom Hanks, and Rita Wilson, Meryl Streep, and other entertainers and artists I looked up to spoke so brightly and lightly, with such wit and intelligence, that it seemed Nora had written their material. She'd planned her service while she was in the hospital, what music would play, and who would speak, and in what order. I thought maybe she'd given everyone direction, something like, be butter, don't be better, just be butter. My favorite note I ever got from Nora was, just be funny, which is why I was thinking that. The butter talk spread its richness naturally into a creamy love and appreciation of the ingredient that savors everything it puts itself in and onto. It's too rich for words like mine. The memorial was at Alice Tully Hall at Lincoln Center. To the right and left of the stage were two enormous planters filled with white-bloomed flowers. The structures towered well over 10 feet high. Her name appeared in an elegant font written on the screen as the song, As Time Goes By, played. Earlier that week, I'd had a dream that Nora and I were backstage before a show, hanging out in front of the dressing room makeup mirror. I reached into her makeup bag and found some blue eyeliner and put it on. We were standing up and we smiled at each other. I thought of taking the makeup pencil at a moment when she wasn't looking. If I took it, I wouldn't be able to come backstage to see her after the show so I could borrow it. The dream made me think of Mildred because I wanted to share it with her. Nora had seen Mildred during her heartburn years, the scandalous book about a former husband, Carl Bernstein, and the affair he had while she was 7 months pregnant. The book was her revenge. And I'll never forget her smile when I asked if the revenge had been sweet. It was a smile that said it had been. Mildred and her husband Bernie Berkowitz led a therapy group in their offices on West 9th Street, off of 5th Avenue, where Lynn Grossman was also in group with Nora. In fact, it was Lynn's husband, Bob Balaban, who connected me with Mildred. We'd wrapped Waiting for Guffman, and were doing Bill Maher's show. At the time, it was called Politically Incorrect. And it was there backstage that he'd asked how I was. It wasn't a casual question, but one to consider truthfully. Bob is someone I describe as directly human. I hadn't been doing well and had found myself zoning out in my apartment, holding a pile of dirty laundry and not moving. I told him I was doing all right, but it wasn't the truth and he knew it. And then he asked, how are you handling your success? I was taken aback and answered, is that what this is? Not very well. He gave me Mildred's number and I went to see her. Mildred Newman was an archetypal great mother. She was playfully nurturing and imaginatively simple. She'd say, your world is not so big as to make yourself so small, nor is your world so small as to make yourself so big. And I think of Alice in Wonderland, who made herself both big and small, and the rabbit hole she got herself into. When I was in a state with a boyfriend, Mildred would say, you must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply. As time goes by. She'd also say, there are two parts to feelings, having them and acting on them. I would still sink in my feelings then, afraid to navigate in order to get out of them. The battery low, my flashlight flickering. She'd say, do what you approve of. And like Jiminy Cricket says to Pinocchio, always let your conscience be your guide. I met Nora before Dazed and Confused, and she cast me in a little part in Sleepless in Seattle that got cut from the film. Afterwards, she wrote me a letter on her stationery explaining that it had nothing to do with me, but the scene just didn't move the story along. In the scene, I knocked on Tom Hanks's door after hearing him on the radio, let loose a gush of fandom, and made a quick exit. In a letter, she said I was a gifted comedian, and she wanted to work with me again, which I felt was genuine, and her support meant everything. And besides, it's not like Sleepless in Seattle did any big business, so I wasn't that upset about it. The next year, she hired me for a movie she was working on called Mixed Nuts. I was cast as Rollerblader number 2, and John Stewart was cast as Rollerblader number 1. So John and I learned how to rollerblade at the Roxy, which was a nightclub in the Meatpacking District. On Sunday afternoons, it turned into a roller rink where we rollerbladed to disco, looking like dorks in our helmets, wrist guards, and knee pads. We shot Mixed Nuts in Santa Monica, in the newly opened Shutters on the Beach, a gorgeous hotel right on the water where we had to stay for 3 weeks. We couldn't believe that we had it so good. And we didn't share more than 15 lines in the film between us. We pretty much just had to rollerblade past Steve Martin holding a Christmas tree. Now that I think of it, we didn't even do that, because our stunt doubles did it for us. I gave Shutters my credit card to check into the place, and John and I went out for burgers close by. When I went to the ATM to get some cash, all I had was $1.75 left in my bank account. My credit card was also my cash card, and I shuddered. Nora happened to be walking by, and I showed her the receipt like it belonged to someone else. She got her wallet out and gave me $100. $1.75 in my bank account. Isn't that too much? It doesn't make sense, right? But all those independent movies I did in the 90s were done in the cheap. I was counting coins, which I'd put in those paper roll-ups to take to the deli so I could buy pasta to make for dinner. I didn't know anyone else who was famous and broke. John Stewart was so funny. I wonder if people know just how funny he is. On the record, I'm saying that he's not only funny, but he's fun. The layout of the rooms at Shutters made the bed super entertaining for us, but not how you're thinking. You could take a bath and open the shutters to see the bed just a few feet away, or you could close the shutters for privacy. No, John wasn't there when I took a bath. After housekeeping cleaned the rooms and tightened the beds to the utmost, we'd team up. We'd start at the toilet, then run, stepping on the bath's ledges, and fly, like Superman, through the open shutters, plummeting across the bed and sliding off the edge. We were like daredevils all of a sudden, since now we knew how to rollerblade. And it's clear to anyone, we were method actors. You know who else is funny and fun? Jimmy Fallon. He has his own TV show now. He was a rising star when I met him, just starting on SNL, and all of 26 years old. I was about to hit 30 and had completed Best in Show in November. I still had braces, but was waiting to take them off until after the new millennium. I don't remember the reason why exactly, except that time was speeding up and I didn't want it to. I wanted to shake off the character of Meg as well as time travel back to the 8th grade, which was the last time I had braces. I wanted things to be new and blushing. For New Year's Eve, Jimmy and I went to his parents' house to bang pots and pans while walking up and down the street, which was Fallon tradition. The house was full of guests, friends of Jimmy and his sister Gloria. It was like Animal House, but instead of frat brothers, the house was full of people resembling elves, much like the Keebler Cookie family. There was so much laughing that it seemed like everyone was on mushrooms. I remember we visited someone's home whose bathroom was chock full of Santa Claus decorations. A Santa cozy on the toilet paper, Santa towels and hand towels. Mrs. Claus by the toothbrush holder, Santa shower curtain, Santa bath mat. I'd meet Jimmy late after his SNL stuff to go out dancing. He's probably the best dancer that has ever lived. I was still anxious about my fame and success and was only really happy when I had a fiction to carry around. Back then, there was no media and being social, so long phone calls were fun, as was going out. I remember seeing Nora around this time. She said to me, "You know, Parker, you will always feel the same. You will just keep getting older." That was stunning news to me, since I'd had this fantasy that after I turned 30, I'd become Mariska Hargitay or another womanly type woman instead of the impish woman child I'll remain forever. I'll always feel the same. And I never exactly fit in. Now that I'm older, I accept myself and realize it's okay to be different. And also okay that a ball gown makes me feel like I got lost in a swath of someone else's curtains that got twisted around my body unsuccessfully. I never wanted to feel like a trophy of myself, because if I did, I suppose I'd feel as if I won something. And if I won something, I might lose my desire to do what I do. I may just knock myself off the pedestal. Winning is lonely. It means more people will talk behind your back. And if they're talking behind your back, then they're more likely to have knives to throw at your back. I would love some coffee. How wonderful. Mildred told me this story over and over again. When Bernie and I, when our book came out, Mildred and her husband Bernie wrote How to Be Your Own Best Friend, which came out in the early 70s and was the first self-help book ever written, or one of them. When Bernie and I, when our book came out, she'd say again, we had lots of success with it. We were famous for it. She'd smile, beaming. And I'd eat some of her tuna fish salad from the Second Avenue Deli that she'd served me on stone ground crackers. She enjoyed the story every time she told it, like a grandmother telling a bedtime story. She took her time, taking you into it. There was a party for the book, and lots of people came. My patients over the years, like Neil Simon, Erica Jong, Richard Benjamin. I was in the kitchen, and this woman, a friend, came up to me and said, you know, you and Bernie have everything. A great marriage, and famous patients, and now this book. Mildred would huff with frustration, imitating her. And I can't stand it. Shaking off her portrayal of this woman, Mildred would shift in her chair, aggravated, shaking her head. She'd pause for the aggravation to leave her. And then this woman said, I want what you have. At which point Mildred would take a deep breath of astonishment and collect herself as if she were still in the moment. And I looked her right in the eyes. And then she'd hold my gaze, lowering her voice for her punchline. And I said, you can't have it. It's mine. She'd penetrate her gaze at me and through me. She'd then lean back and slowly smile. And we'd sit there. Once, after a breakup I couldn't get over, the guy married a girlfriend of mine soon after. Mildred said, I want you to put him in front of you, and I want you to chop his head off with an axe. 28. Being a twin. It's funny, the response I get when I tell people I have a twin brother is almost always, are you identical? No, he has something I don't have, I say. Then I watch their face register what that something is. I explain that identical twins share the same egg, whereas fraternal twins each have their own egg. They usually say, oh, I knew that. Then they ask if we have that twin thing, where I know what he's thinking, or can sense when he's in trouble. We're more opposite sides of the same coin, is my rote response. But there was one time, on a trip to Monroe, where we were silent for a good while, and then I brought up the name of a girl we were in second grade with, and he said he was just thinking of her. That happened once. There's a mole between my pinky finger and ring finger that he shares, but it's on his opposite foot. He got most of the potent DNA, like skin pigment, thicker hair, and eyes that are a deeper green. He's also taller than I am, which shouldn't surprise you. When I told Mildred all this, she directed me to Freud's theory of penis envy, but I never liked the sound of it. I suppose the thought that a man came up with this idea made me jealous. She'd explained that Freud's idea says that boys view their penises as gifts, like a birthday present for boys only, which lasts for the rest of their lives. And girls wait for their gifts to appear when they hit puberty in the form of breasts. I didn't buy into this because I never looked at my breasts as presents. I wonder if Mildred or Freud would say, my penis envy castrated my breasts in order to have my own figurative penis. My mother summed it up nicely when I'd asked her if she ever wanted one. I never wanted any of that stuff between my legs. This conversation's ridiculous. My analyst Mark would say to just drop it, and so I will. No, that wasn't a castration joke. Or was it? Let's take a break and look at the SkyMall catalog. It's fun to look at all the weird home stuff you never really see in people's homes. There should be a word for the fear of opening one's own mail. There should also be a phrase besides, excuse me, for when someone is standing in front of the very thing you want. It should be something funny that would make you both laugh. These solar panel footprints that light up at night in your backyard are funny. I'll order these for my funeral. If you want me again, look for me above my solar panel footprints. I wonder if there will ever be an off-the-grid airline. Maybe I'll finally get to Burning Man and pitch that idea to some Silicon Valley types. If they're going to make body pillows, they should make them look more like bodies. Give the pillow a face. Being a twin is confusing. When you're a baby, you're not aware of being in your own body yet. So you identify and think of yourself as the other person. The me, myself, and I comes later. That's why a mother's nurturing gaze into her child is so important. So when the child grows up, the nurturing mother will live inside. If not, it's up to the individual to create her. But if you have a twin, you have this melding of the other person from the get-go. My mom says she'd watch us speaking in mumbles and gestures while we played for hours passing toys to each other. Goo-ga-ga-ga, Chris would say. Nam-na, I'd reply. It was mostly pleasant and reciprocal. Who knows what fantasies and promises were agreed upon then, what was promised and wished for, and was then granted in my imagination. And then the disappointment or confusion with what wasn't granted. I recognize a particular loneliness and confusion when I meet other female twins, a puzzled disillusionment. We talk about the desire to have another person's eyes see like yours, their mind think like yours, their heart beat like yours, how easily the other comes alive inside. It's nice that we've kept these maps on the screen. I made a twin friend in Vancouver named Anna. She had a vintage clothing store in Gastown just blocks from me in Chinatown called Duchess. Anna was down the street getting her hair cut when we met at Nicole's One Chair Hair Salon. Nicole is pop art chic with a bobbed haircut, Liza Minnelli eyes, and red lipstick that never smears. She wears art smocks, loose mom pants, and jazz flats. She's cool, but nice, and ready to laugh. She also carries a Narcan pack, in case she sees an addict dying on the sidewalk, which she's used a few times. I liked her immediately, and we became fast friends. I respected how she manifested becoming her own boss at a one-chair hair salon, and asked how she tore herself away from the drama of the many-chair hair salon world, which can be fraught with personalities and unnecessary hierarchy. She told me at my first haircut for Dr. Smith that I had something to do with it. Her first and only boss suggested she change her name to attract more clients, and so she went by Parker for a while. She was laughing and freaking out a little that she was about to give her double a haircut. Then she said she knew I liked her haircuts because years ago, when I was doing Best in Show, I'd complimented one of her clients' haircuts on the street. We riffed on the idea of the sisterhood of the traveling haircuts, connecting stories through strands of hair, braids of hair, hair and drains, hairballs and cats. I liked watching her hands as she cut my hair. The scissors and extension of her fingers, more like an artist and less like a haircutter. The scissors were Japanese, gold and small, and she'd flip them easily into her palm and then out like a card flying out of its deck. Being a twin is a predicament you're born into. Wrapping your head around being a twin, the idea that you can't be one without the other, is confusing enough. The answer is simple, though. I don't know anything different. I was shooting a short film in Watford, England, and I don't remember much about it. The director wore cow print pants the first day. I remember that much. One of the locations was in a mental hospital that was still functioning. I think they shot some of Harry Potter there. It's a ghoulish and beautiful old building, a historic landmark. A bunch of us actors were hanging out under a tree when a schizophrenic patient, shirtless and carrying a wooden branch as a staff, walked toward us, smiling like a figure come to life from a tarot card. He was gorgeous and happy, blonde, blue-eyed and tan, barefoot and in cutoffs. I was lying down as he approached. "Look at you. You're a Porsche car," he said. He had a thick Scottish accent. I'd never been called that, but liked the sound of it. "My dad has a car dealership," I said. He liked this connection very much. "You're my sister," he said. I told him that I have a twin brother. "I have a sister. You are my twin." Then the strangest thing, he started counting. 1 and 1 is 2. You are my twin. He was excited, saying all of this in sing-song. 2 threes are 6, and 2 threes put together make an 8, and 8 is DNA, and it connects us all. "Whoa, you just said the numbers of my birthday," I said. 11, 8, 68. "You are my twin. You are my sister. We are connected." I was taken with him at this point. We all were. But there was a woman behind us, waiting for him. He pointed upward. "There's a string connecting that goes up to the sky and into my head and through the center of the earth." He's gesturing this. "I listen to Tina Turner music and I shake." His knees were pumping to a song. He had a yellow Walkman clipped to his pants and headphones around his neck. Remember those? "You're a car," he said, his R's rolling in that Scottish accent. "You're a Porsche car. 2 threes make 8, and 8 is DNA, and it connects us all. It connects us all." And he threw his arms out in a grand gesture as if on his way to the King's Court and walked to his therapist, his lady in waiting. I covered my face when he left and cried into my hands. We all just looked at each other with our mouths open like, "What was that?" One of the extras that day, who was with us under that tree, had known someone who went to college with me. His friend was the girlfriend of a film student who had drowned, and I had dated the film student's friend who committed suicide a few years later. I learned of his death from a friend of his who told me in a Chinese restaurant in Chelsea. I had been away filming when it happened, and he dropped the news in passing, which was cruel. I was famous, so what could hurt me? I covered my face with my hands and cried in the same way I did after talking to that schizophrenic patient. Simon was the name of the man in Watford. I'm just remembering this because I remember thinking of the game Simon Says. I asked about him later to his lady in waiting. Against protocol, I'm sure, the lady told me that he had murdered his sister. In The House of Yes, I played a young woman, a twin, so obsessed with Jackie O and the JFK assassination that she's made a game of it with her twin brother. It was writer Wendy McLeod's Yale thesis and was a filmed play, really. It's all contained in one house over Thanksgiving. I played Jackie, a young woman who isn't taking her meds and freaks out when her brother Marty, the love of her life, brings home a date. The sublime Josh Hamilton played my brother and Tori Spelling played his fiancée. She was terrific. Geneviève Bugeaud, the French-Canadian actress, played my mother, and she presided over all of us. Her vibe had the intensity that only comes from being French or half-French. Did you see Dead Ringers? It's the movie where Jeremy Irons plays twins, and Geneviève plays his love interest. Jeremy Irons. Do they make men like that anymore? Anyway, I was 25, and she was around the age I am now. And after saying I was talented, she said to wait until after my 40s, when I'd be more grounded, because that was when it would get really interesting. I've never forgotten that, and she was right, of course. In the movie, I kill my brother, shoot him, while reenacting the Zapruder film one last time. The night before filming began, I took one of those razor callus removers and dug too deep, gashing my foot to the point that it hurt to walk in Jackie's pumps. After filming, I was pretty freaked out, so I called Mildred and she talked me down. When I talked to my real brother about all this, Chris said something like, "Don't worry about it, Jesus, that's crazy." We couldn't be more different. He practices law down south and with my sister-in-law does my accounting and contract stuff. They manage my business. They swept in after I'd gotten screwed by Kenneth Starr, accountant to the Starrs who ran a Ponzi scheme and went to jail. You've got mail was more like, you've got my money, so they flew in to help. This is funny. A Mai Tai send a men's t-shirt. I should get that for Chris. A John Lemon t-shirt? Are you serious? They should make a bananas t-shirt that smells like bananas. I'd wear that. Or one with an airplane that smells like this. Ooh, gross. Speaking of smells, Anna, the vintage clothing store owner, took me rag picking at one of the rag yards about 30 miles from Vancouver. It's where she gets clothes for her store. It's in a warehouse space run by an Indian family where these oversized post office bins, the size of a dining room table, were full of other people's discarded clothes. The stuff came from America, as far away as Utah, as well as from Canada. There was some kind of system or arrangement with all the other pickers, but Anna asked if it was okay for me to come, and they said yes. You climb into the bins, wearing a surgical mask, and you rummage. It smells, but you get used to it. It's a colorful place. The workers use forklifts to pick up packs of smushed clothing and plastic wrap, as big as a refrigerator, and then load it into bins where they separate it into categories, dresses, shirts, t-shirts, kids' clothes. I took my shoes off and sat in the dresses and chatted with Anna's friend, a fellow scavenger named Megan. She was wearing a toque knit cap, the standard wear for damp rainy days in Vancouver. We had loose and laid-back chatter. Not as much of the ambitious, non-versation work stuff you can get in the city. I know that jumping into a giant bin of smelly hand-me-downs is not for everyone, but when people ask what it's like being a twin, my trip to the rag yard is a good analogy. How fun and satisfying it was to sink into the massive clothing and think about the lives people led in those garments. All the different sizes, fabrics, and trends. This person's size, that person's size, this age, that decade. The special occasion dress, worn maybe just a few times. The house coats of the 60s and 70s. The muumuus. Millions of people's lives were lived in those clothes. I like being on the hunt and hope that even a conversation comes to life and there's a sense, even just a thread, a feeling connected. Those threads shoot out and tangle tightly or loosely and take form inside as a whole. It's also fabricated. I make a twin for myself whenever I play a part. 29. Wait till spring. It had been at least a year since I'd been on the mat, but I got back to my yoga practice in Vancouver before my shooting began for Lost in Space. I had 6 weeks off before Dr. Smith entered the series full on, so I would live there until I started shooting and stay all the way through July. The Robinson family would be on a glacier built on a soundstage, with fake snow particles blown from industrial fans the size of a breakfast table. Snow the size of oatmeal going up their noses. They would be moving in spacesuits made of car upholstery material, which inhibited normal movement of any kind, especially the lifting of arms. I would be taking in Vancouver and the rain, wearing everyday clothing. I'd love a hot cookie, and you can refer to me as one too if you'd like. My dad has a picture that he keeps in his wallet that he likes to pull out of his pride and joy on one side and his kids on the other. It's the old pun of the laundry detergent and the dish soap on one side and the kids, which are two goats, on the other. I gave him a card that says stop talking that's typeset lowercase on a sturdy white business card. I'll give you one once we land. It was record-breaking rain in January 2017, the most they'd seen in 60 years. The locals talk about the rain and the weather like it's their culture, and loved that. They apologized about the rain whenever I introduced myself as being from out of town. I'd say, I love it. When the snow came, they apologized about that too, when it wasn't even cold enough to stick. I'd mentioned the winter in New York when it got so cold that I'd wrap my scarf around my neck, including my face, so I looked like a Muppet. Wait till spring, they said. It made me smile because it felt so small town, like you're sitting on the front porch with Granny. I'm in a rocking chair, shelling peas, shucking corn, talking about the weather, how handsome that Justin Trudeau is. I ate it all up. Justin Trudeau had his coffee at the same place I had mine. It was a place called the Brixton. It felt like The Commitments, the high-spirited movie from the 90s that took place in an Irish pub where they'd sing out of nowhere. There was a competition where they could win a trip somewhere. It was directed by Alan Parker, who did Fame and Bugsy Malone, both classics. Anyway, I could see the Brixton from my room on the 18th floor of Blue Sky Properties, Chinatown. There was an assisted living facility for drug addicts smack in the middle of the Brixton sister bar called the London Pub, which was right on the corner. The first yoga class I took was on Hastings Street, which reminded me of Chelsea in the early 90s during the crack epidemic. There was a homeless man in the Chelsea days who liked my corner, who I'd give change to and chat with. He was good-natured despite living on the edge. He told me he recognized me from As the World Turns, and I didn't know how that was possible. He was homeless. Did he watch it on a television set in his storefront window? I asked him, but he wouldn't give me a straight answer. It positively mystified me. When I didn't see him anymore, I thought of him as Clarence Oddbody, the in-between world's angel who appeared when Jimmy Stewart wanted to commit suicide in It's a Wonderful Life. Strange, isn't it? Each man's life touches so many other lives. And when he isn't around, he leaves an awful hole, doesn't he? That movie couldn't be made today because Clarence would have just told Jimmy Stewart, there's medication for what you're going through, George Bailey. On Hastings, there were even more addicts living on the sidewalks because drugs aren't really illegal in Canada. There are dispensaries where they can get methadone to wean themselves off the hard stuff with the light stuff. Now there is fentanyl, which can get you off all the stuff and into nowhere. There are the marijuana places to get pot that doesn't get you high but takes the pain away. It isn't unusual to see needles strewn on the streets or to look down alleyways and think of Night of the Living Dead as people drift walk to make their deals, their bodies jumping out of their skin, causing them to shake what they were kicking with a spurt of energy like an overcome fan at a rock show where the bass solo has become overbearing and painful and you have to dance like Billy Squire to get comfortable. I thought of the strange music one man must have been hearing in his brain when I saw him humping a garbage can and playing drums on it at the same time. And I saw many skinny bodies looking close to death itself. There was a blonde woman in pigtails with the particular style of a talisman, fringing on the edge and receiving the guidance of the gods. She was probably around my age and dressed in rainbow colors that were mismatched. She pointed at me laughing like she knew me, and I smiled back at her as we were both crossing the street. When she passed me, she said, "Hey, crazy lady, it's good to see you came out." "Right on, me too." The way the community existed in harmony made me think of bees returning to a strange and self-destructive honeycomb. Their system was working, and they didn't have to confuse it further with prison. They didn't have to be locked up. It just felt more humane over there, like they give people a chance, even if everyone else is paying for it. One life to live, you know? We're really not here that long. In the same neighborhood, there was a brand new yoga studio called Stretch. It was a huge industrial space that had been remodeled in the same modern and recycled style that I'd seen in Berlin. The front room was huge with lots of light, and I was greeted by a nervous greyhound when I entered. It belonged to the owner, a French woman named Emmanuelle, who had her hair wrapped in a scarf in gleaner fashion. She was sitting on a bench and warming her back by the fireplace. It wasn't a real fireplace, but an assemble-yourself modern design made of cardboard logs with self-contained battery-powered light bulbs placed underneath for glow. She was breastfeeding her baby as I sat down and introduced myself and then signed up for class. I'd taken another class at a donation-only place where you pay however much you want. It's called Yoga to the People, and they have a studio in New York. You can go when we land. It's great because it's so varied experience-wise, and it's crowded to the point of becoming private. The teacher asked the students to share something they were grateful for, and several said that spring was coming soon. This was January. When the long-haired blonde fellow in front of me said that he, too, was grateful for the upcoming spring, I scooted up my mat and asked him why I kept hearing this. That it was January, and it was supposed to be cold. He shook his long blonde mane. Well, I live on a boat off one of the islands, and this weather's not good for sleeping, he said. When spring comes, you'll see this place is different in the spring. Stretch had a teacher named Risto, who became my favorite. He teaches a rocket class, which is a self-made series that he learned from one of his teachers. He speeds you through some key poses of the Ashtanga practice to get you stronger for, say, handstands in the middle of the room. Straight up. Like a rocket. He describes the series as a shortcut, but it's cool. It's copacetic. Risto is short for Christopher, someone pointed out. He smiled big when I saw him at first, recognizing me for my work, which I mistook for flirting. He's very handsome and over 6 feet tall and covered in tattoos. He'd been in showbiz as a creature actor and stunt worker, but he left all that to do something more meaningful and less of a grind. He got tired of the 15-hour days dressed as a predator or snake man character and ripping all that stuff off his face and body once the day was done. It was easy to go to his class. He was inspiring. He took the Vancouver people, our outdoorsy vibe, to a whole other level. He skied and snowboarded. And when I noticed he was limping, he mentioned an impending hip surgery that wasn't his first. When I asked what happened, he laughed and shrugged. You know, flying into trees. I like the difference of these men, a type I imagined to be specific to the Pacific Northwest, active in the manly way I'd mostly only seen on TV. Keanu Reeves, Evel Knievel, Michael Phelps, Liam Neeson, Bjorn Borg. I like thinking about what creates that force, that speed, that grace, and that authenticity. And a good man is just fantastic. I'm thinking now of Manly from Little House in the Prairie. He was twice the size of Laura, or half pint. Manly's full name was Almanzo, which was a strange name for a prairie man in the middle of nowhere. So everyone called him Manny. Laura mistook his name for Manly, and he said she was the only one who could call him that. Manly wore mainly khakis and linen button-down shirts and donned a dusty beige pioneer hat, which was the fashion then in prairie times. He'd enter scenes mopping his brow with a hand towel from the sweat of chopping wood. Or he'd be yodeling, having finished his carpentry work. In Lost in Space, we had our very own creature actor, Brian Steele, who played our robot. I had met him during Blade Trinity when he played the Beast. I'd conversed and snacked with the devil, you could say, and he was really a nice guy underneath all that rubber and plastic and horns and glue. I'd found myself drawn to him and listening to his stories, which involved so much physical prowess that I was humbled. I think he's ridden his bicycle around the world. He still had that same force and energy now. At his first reading as a robot, he showed up in costume looking all fierce. And I held my iPhone to his body, asking to check my email. He took it almost as a slight to his character, but was good-humored about it. Brian smiles most of the time, with the satisfaction of endurance that makes athletes high. He sported a short mohawk that swooped on the top of his head like the top of a soft-serve ice cream cone. His voice naturally boomed without being overbearing. In the Stretch studio, I cried in Risto's class. And not because he didn't ask me out or I'd never gotten a tattoo. I had started breathing again. That Ujjayi Star Wars breath. I started to let go of all that had been overwhelming. The past few years had been a meltdown of my Porsche, and then of everything that I couldn't control, like the strangeness of the culture. And to quote Dave Chappelle, when has America ever given a fuck about how anyone feels inside? The disastrous happenings, everywhere, all over the world. The weather, for instance, easily causing turmoil and taking over the peace of mind of absolutely everybody. And the guns. What's the Lou Reed song where he says that people just don't act rational, that they think they're just on TV? I have a Lou Reed story, but we're landing soon. Many yoga classes end with a prayer. May all beings be free from suffering. Risto ended his class with that, as well as, be kind to everyone out there. All my teachers and mothers and fathers out there, especially my actual parents. And my brothers and sisters, especially my twin. Bless them, everyone, everything. It takes courage to live a life, as Mildred said. And hold on to yourself, everybody. We never expected life to look like this, and it will never look like this again. Grace is hard-earned. There aren't enough books about loneliness, was another thing Mildred said. After class, I stopped in the front room and sat by the makeshift fireplace. There were colorful pieces of stretch fabric hanging from the ceiling, maybe 10 of them. I asked Emmanuel about them. Is this for acro yoga or Iyengar yoga? And she said they weren't for either. They were for the hammock classes, an idea that she'd come up with, saying, people come to lie in the hammocks and listen to live cello music. I wondered if hammock classes were a thing in Canada. She said no, not that she knew of. So she had figured, why not? How French of her. How Canadian. I went to lie down in the yellow one. The fabric was as big as a tablecloth, and I stretched my body out in it and swung, sinking my weight into the yellow, which enveloped me like the sun. And I started to get excited for spring. How do I land? Something. Come here. This is Parker Posey. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of You're on an Airplane, a self-mythologizing memoir. This program was directed by Maureen Monterubio. Executive producer, Karen Jukonski. The sound design was by Heather Scott and Ted Scott, who also edited the program. Recording engineer, Stephanie Ciccatello. Music by Hal Hartley. Text copyright 2018 by Parker Posey. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.